It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. One of Pittsburgh's largest philanthropies is turning to a familiar name to be its next leader. The Pittsburgh Foundation's board of directors has selected Lisa Schroeder as its new president. Lisa, of course, well known for her leadership at River Life. Lisa Schroeder is on the line with us from Baltimore. Welcome to the Confluence, Lisa.
I'm so happy to be here.
As part of full disclosure, we want to mention that the Pittsburgh Foundation is a financial supporter of WESA. So, Lisa, you are leaving your hometown of Baltimore to come back to your second home, Pittsburgh. How does that feel?
I believe I have two hometowns. Clearly, I am devoted to both. I am really thrilled to be moving back to Pittsburgh. I have watched the trajectory of so many things, positive things happening in Pittsburgh over the last few years, and it's a thrill to be able to come back and participate.
Max King, a friend of yours, is retiring as president in June of the Pittsburgh Foundation, and you will be just the sixth president overall of the Pittsburgh Foundation. I mean, they've been around for nearly 75 years, and you'll also be the first woman president. Does one carry more weight than the other for you?
Well, I don't think very many people have the privilege that I will have of succeeding Max, who is not only a friend, but a mentor, and was a first chair at River Life when I began as director. So I have known Max as the power that he is for many years, and so many of the things that I'm proudest of, I've been able to work on with Max. So that is a true thrill. I'm also thrilled to be the first woman president, of course, and with the first woman chair. Edie Shapiro is still the first woman chair. So here we come.
In that announcement about your selection, you called Max King a mentor, but also visionary. How so?
Yes. Well, and let me start with the vision that the foundation is pursuing, which is also, you know, a framework and a set of priorities around 100% Pittsburgh, really focusing on providing support in all ways to the at least 30% of the population that is still left out of prosperity and progress. That is an incredibly important and fundamental mission. I believe that it's characteristic of Max to focus on those who need it most. And I look forward to learning so much as the foundation has done outreach and collected data and conversations around what is needed most in Pittsburgh.
Has the board sort of given you an idea of how they would like you to build upon Max's work and his predecessors as well?
I think the board and I would agree that the most important start will be a great deal of listening. There is so much to build on. There is so much work that has been done, committing to conversations with community leaders and conversations in the community so that I can really acclimate and find out what is top on people's minds and where I can continue the highest level of impact for the foundation.
Is that your thoughts about what makes a good leader, or at least one characteristic, being a good listener first?
I believe that. I also believe, and I learned this in the great city of Pittsburgh, living and working in Pittsburgh, that collaboration and partnerships are behind every kind of push for transformative change. I do believe that in Pittsburgh, where philanthropy reaches out to government and business and all sectors collaborate, that it really is the secret to the great advances of success that Pittsburgh has had.
I want to follow up on something you said a little bit earlier. You said, look out, here we come, with sort of a bit of a chuckle in your voice. But does it add any pressure to you, though, or not? Or is the fact that you are so familiar with Pittsburgh and you're so well known here?
It's lovely to hear that I'm well known. I believe that the progress will continue. I think that there are so many great leaders in Pittsburgh. I'm not worried about distinguishing myself among leadership, because I think there's so much great work to be done, and there's so many people that will be side by side. I think that leadership is a process among many, and I'm thrilled to have the distinction of being the first woman. But I think that first and foremost is leadership focused on what is needed most.
You come into this post, you're not just familiar with Pittsburgh, but also with the Pittsburgh Foundation. I believe you were a member of the board of directors of the foundation from 2008 to 2011. How much of a factor was that familiarity to your interest in this post?
It meant everything. I have always believed that the Pittsburgh Foundation and the board is a respectful institution where people with differing opinions can come together in a safe place to have conversation about things that matter. And that tradition is very precious to me, and I believe it's precious to Pittsburgh. And it's a deep honor to be asked to step into the leadership role. I went on to the board in 2008. During the economic collapse, and was able to see the role that the foundation played, stepping in where needed, and have seen so many times the foundation taking a lead role in campaigns like Why Cut What Works around the same time. So that's a tradition that I'm honored to carry forward.
It's interesting, you taking on a role of a director at that time, probably a time when foundations, philanthropies were maybe needed at their most.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that in the ensuing years, we have learned more and more deeply that nonprofit organizations, particularly small service organizations who are on the ground, are under more and more pressure to find resources to support the good work that they do. And so community foundations, I believe, have a more important role in Pittsburgh and in this country than ever before.
Last week, the foundation announced it had raised a record-breaking $68 million last year. How much of your job will be fundraising, and how much will be to identify critical community issues, critical community needs?
I would say both and both. Both are critically important. One supports the other, and I plan to be extremely busy on both endeavors.
Part of the identification of needs and issues is sort of, I guess, convening various stakeholders. What is your approach to that in bringing people together to address some of the issues?
Yes, I think that there's been a great deal of that needs to be continued. And for me, it will be a real thrill to be able to learn personally and firsthand from conversations on the ground what people are thinking of. I would be very much in support of developing a series of community conversations, including, of course, the Westmoreland Foundation, which was now part of the Pittsburgh Foundation. I will need to hear from the sensational staff and board at the Pittsburgh Foundation what they have been thinking about, what they've been working on, and then develop a fresh approach going forward.
How do you see the role of the foundation? Here you have this major influence, this major asset in Western Pennsylvania, but how do you make sure that this big player is truly connected to the needs of the community at the grassroots level?
I think your question about community conversations is absolutely critical. I've found at numerous times in my working life that the best way to determine what is needed, really put the time in to listening. You may recall that at River Life, we did over 120 public meetings in order to pull forward the hopes and dreams that people had for the riverfronts. I think that we'll think about what is the most dynamic way to collect information, and the key to information is really what people themselves have to say and have to put on the table.
at the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned that you feel you have two hometowns. So have you been back in Pittsburgh since you left to go back to Baltimore?
Many times.
Okay.
It's a short 4-hour drive, and I have many friends and family and love the city.
When you cross those rivers, what do you think about, considering all the years you led the effort?
It still feels a little bit miraculous in the most wonderful way to see people convened by the thousands on the riverfront. My most vivid memory was the night that the duck, the public art, great inflatable duck was pulled up the Allegheny River, and on all sides of the riverfronts, people of all ages from all over the region were crowded, singing and dancing and waving to see it. And I remember sending an email to all of those leaders who started the River Life Task Force on the basis of a dream, and saying, look, you did it. The riverfronts are indeed a center of community life. And that's been the thrill of a lifetime.
Responsible riverfront development can enhance the quality of life in the region. So as president of the Pittsburgh Foundation, you're going to have the opportunity to improve the quality of life on a wider scale. How are you going to approach that?
That's right. That's the profound sense of responsibility that I have as the next leader of the Pittsburgh Foundation, because the Pittsburgh Foundation, as you noted, has an incredible history, long history of supporting and improving the condition of people's lives in health and human services, in medicine, in science, in the arts, in the environment. So many ways to make the condition of people's lives better. And this is a foundation that has reached out in all ways to do their best for as many people as possible. That is an awe-inspiring challenge, and I am so excited to be able to take up that challenge.
Lisa Schroeder, former president and CEO of Riverlife, currently the CEO of the Parks and People Foundation of Baltimore, has been selected as the new president of the Pittsburgh Foundation, succeeding Max King in June. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. See you in Pittsburgh.
And full disclosure, the Pittsburgh Foundation is a financial supporter of WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin, and you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Entertainers as politicians is reality in 2019, but 30 years ago, the novelty factor was pretty new. Tiny Tim, the very tall, falsetto-voiced uke player, announced his bid for mayor of New York City on this day in 1989. Tim, a member of the New Age Party, tiptoed out of the race 5 weeks later, saying, "My campaign fizzled as flat as this beer." His Republican challenger, though, stayed in. Rudy Giuliani lost his first bid for mayor that year to Democrat David Dinkins. Giuliani would run again and win in 1993. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In the days ahead, Pittsburgh City Council is expected to vote on whether to pass new gun control regulations in city limits. But advocates on both sides say this will only be the beginning of a drawn-out court fight. As 90.5 WESA's Ariel Worthy reports, another 6-year-old battle proves that sometimes passing the law is the easiest part.
In 2012, Natalia Rudiak remembers driving down Route 51 when she saw a billboard of her face being put up.
And the billboards that were going around town were saying, "Say no to Natalia's new tax. Worst economy in 50 years, Natalia Rudiak says raise taxes."
Rudiak was a Pittsburgh city councilor at the time. The signs were placed by the billboard's owner, Lamar Advertising. It was the company's response to a 10% tax on billboard sales that she co-sponsored. Lamar owns about 4,000 billboards in the region, more than any other company. Council passed the tax, and former Mayor Luke Ravenstahl allowed it to become law without his signature. The city estimated the tax could generate up to $2 million a year. Instead, it generated a lawsuit. Lamar sued the city in 2013, arguing that the tax is illegal under state law and the Constitution. The case has dragged on ever since. At one point, a trial was slated for this past November, but it was postponed, and there have been no new court filings since September. Lamar didn't respond to requests for comment, but attorney Jonathan Kamen never made a secret of the company's plans.
I'd ask you, as you think about whether this is good policy or whether this is right for Pittsburgh, if you think the answer is yes, I guess we'll see you in court.
That's Kamen addressing counsel in 2012. He said the tax reflected a bias against billboards because it targeted outdoor advertising.
We're well aware that there's a history here of animus towards the outdoor advertising industry. And today's taxation and this excise tax is nothing new about that.
Some supporters of the tax do oppose billboards, and they're disappointed at the delay. One of them is Mike DeWita of Scenic Pittsburgh, which advocates for the region's scenic resources. Standing near the North Side's Rivers Casino, DeWita gazes at his least favorite view of the city. From here to Mount Washington, he can see three billboards at once.
First, you have an electronic billboard, which lights the world for a long way out. Then you have a standard sign, which doesn't have much to do with anything that's beneficial to the community. And then you have the sign on Mount Washington surrounded by a park. You have three different kinds of signs defacing what is one of the great views of America and maybe the world.
Philadelphia has a billboard tax of 7%, which produced $2.9 million in revenue last year. Philadelphia was sued over its tax, but reached a settlement that dramatically reduced costs for billboard companies. That's why Mary Tracy of Scenic Philadelphia says her group doesn't consider the tax a win.
We did everything we could to try to challenge that settlement agreement, but we don't have the resources, frankly, to be able to go against not only the billboard industry, but our own city.
Duquesne University Law School professor Bruce Ledowitz says based on previous court rulings, Lamar has a strong case, and the company is saving money by making it, unless they lose.
I mean, any time you put off paying taxes, you know, that's good as far as a business is concerned, but you do have to pay interest on the money that you should have been paying all along.
Ledowitz said it's no surprise the city isn't trying to enforce the tax. If the city lost its legal fight, it would have to give the money back. And he says state law often makes it difficult for local officials to advance new ideas on their own.
In Pennsylvania, city ordinances are not the way to change policy. The way to change policy is in Harrisburg.
The city declined comment on the billboard tax, saying it doesn't comment on matters in litigation. I'm Ariel Worthy, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Taking care of what came before us can be a lofty goal, especially for young people, often too burdened by their own debts to be able to contribute through traditional sources like foundations or large-scale charitable giving. One group in Pittsburgh is taking another tack. Matthew Craig is the executive director of the Pittsburgh nonprofit, the Young Preservationists Association. Welcome back to Pittsburgh Community Broadcasting, Matthew.
Thank you. Nice to be back here, Megan.
For our newer listeners, Matthew served as the host of the Allegheny Front program from 1997 to 2009. But tell us more about your work with preservationism right now.
Well, I like what you said at the beginning of the conversation because it is about giving young people the tools. And really, the word is the empowerment, this recognition that they can contribute to the conversations that are having the people are having about historic resources. And I think that Pittsburgh has such a unique architectural fabric. What our organization has really excelled in since it was founded in 2002 by Dan Holland has been engaging young people in historic preservation. We've been very good at finding where places are that need some love and also just why they have value to the community. And what we're bringing to the toolbox now is the how. How do you do it? And how to do it is complicated. It takes a lot of networking and use of historic tax credits and new market tax credits and low-income tax credits. So a lot of financial pieces. But ultimately, it's the same thing. We're trying to teach younger people how they can participate and have a voice in historic preservation.
So when we say historic preservation, what does that mean? What does it look like? What kinds of places and spaces are you trying to save?
Well, a great example is the Penmaquis Hotel in McKeesport, which has been bedeviling the Mon Valley residents for decades. And we were reached out to by some other groups and then ultimately the city of McKeesport itself to come in and try to help them get a plan together on if they can save this historic hotel, what would that look like? And just to give people some reference to this hotel, it's the same architect that did the William Penn Hotel downtown, which is a beautiful gem of a place. And also the same architect that did the old Penn Lincoln Hotel, which is no longer in Wilkinsburg. So if I point to the William Penn or I point to a parking lot, I can say to the folks in McKeesport, well, which of those two do you want? And that's what the stark reality is does the thing get ripped out and bulldozed, or do we restore it and bring it back to new life?
So does that mean just buildings and spaces, or can it include historical accountings of these places as well?
So you have this notion of the bricks and the mortar and, you know, those very real pieces, you know, in the physical space. But I do think that there's also ideas, there's art, there are documents that can also fall under that notion. And I think sometimes it's just what kinds of pieces are in need of being kind of presented and put in front of the public to notice.
I'm curious, do you think that Pittsburgh does a good job incorporating that architectural history into its grander plans for regional economic development?
I think it tries to. I would really have to give it good marks for the very worthwhile efforts and the good-hearted people that are trying to be the watchdogs. And that doesn't mean that every single thing that should have been saved has been saved. There are some very noticeable losses. And a lot of people really kind of fought and died on the notion of trying to save the Civic Arena. But there were other folks that were saying, yeah, but the Civic Arena really ripped out these whole other places, and that was a bigger loss. So it can get to be very controversial, and it can get to be very heated on what should happen. And I think ultimately you have to take a larger, longer view of these things. But generally, I think Pittsburgh has done an excellent job. Groups like the Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation have been real leaders, Preservation Pittsburgh, and of course YPA. You know, I think we're all trying to make sure that the place is, that it keeps its fabric of historic assets.
So E for effort, but any big successes so far?
What's been interesting about the Young Preservationists Association, and our organization has spawned copycats around the region and the country. There is this whole young preservationist movement that is taking place, and it's also now being helped along by the National Trust. But our organization and those other organizations have mostly focused on education. That has been the key part of the DNA. What we're trying to do now is an expansion of our mission, and this is one of the reasons when we got funded by the Allegheny Foundation to hire an executive director, which is how I got here. It was also this idea of what more can we do? And I think the idea of preserving something, it's like what Ben Franklin said, that which you would seem to be really. So the idea that we could actually preserve something would be what the work ahead of us is, and have young people involved step by step in that.
So talking about that educational component, how do you get young people involved in a project? Is it specific? Is it on a larger scale? Is it more learning about some of these architectural concepts?
It's all the above. It's trying to meet people where they are and to show them what's happening around them. We did a wonderful program fairly recently at Perry Traditional Academy. It's called Preservation Podcasts. And if anyone's interested in this after I tell the story, they can find the podcasts on our website. But the notion was, when we first started to talk to the high school students about preservation, you know, they kind of looked at us like we were talking in Greek. Because how does that relate to what their day-to-day experience of in their neighborhoods? And for some of the children, they said that they felt unsafe in their walk from where they lived to school. And that's a very real thing to encounter. So when you start talking about lofty ideas like preservation, when people are more involved in self-preservation, that can be quite a thing. But what was interesting was through the course of the classes and the podcast is that we were able to connect the idea of self-dignity involved in historic preservation. It's kind of the opposite of the broken window syndrome. If a window is broken in a neighborhood and no one bothers to fix it, then it really kind of gives a symbol, a statement to everybody else that it just doesn't matter whether you fix that window or not. And it doesn't matter if I pick up my garbage, and it doesn't matter if I, you know, clean up after my dog. But when somebody does restore an old home in a neighborhood, it elevates everybody in the neighborhood. And it can really be a force for a renewal of spirit as well as the architecture, because people say, oh, they did that, maybe I can do that, maybe I can help with them and they can help with me. And so this notion that the children have, and they call that an education, the light bulb moment, when they get this notion of like, oh, that's why this would matter, oh, and that's why I think this would be a good thing. In this notion, do some buildings get preserved because their history is louder than other buildings? And who speaks for the buildings that aren't speaking so loudly? And that was the part of empowerment, where they recognize that I could do that. I can get a can of paint. I can learn how to become a carpenter. And one of the pieces that is difficult for all the building arts in this whole region, they don't have enough bricklayers. They don't have enough trained carpenters. And these can be very well-paying jobs. So that's part of it, too, is that you can contribute. And I guess really when it gets down to what is young preservation about, you can contribute. And here's how we can show you. And you're welcome to come in.
Talking about young people, in your mind, who exactly qualifies? Who's the YPA for?
If you're young at heart, as the old song goes, I think that some other organizations around the country say, well, it's 20 to 40. But our young preservationists are high school and in grade school. I just got an email a couple of days ago. I was actually on my way to the Penn McKee to talk with a developer that's showing some interest in coming in and restoring the building, which is wonderful. But, you know, you get into this and you have your nose to the grindstone, and every day you're just trying to push this rock up the hill like Sisyphus. And I got an email from a young girl from the fifth grade, and it says, from a fifth grader, I love what YPA does, and I want to be a young preservationist, and I want to know how can we save places like the Penn McKee Hotel. I'm like, oh, goodness, I'm just on my way there now. You never know when you're going to receive something like that, or when you send a note like that, how it's going to uplift the person who gets it. And honestly, it made my week. And I wrote the young girl back, and I said so. But the point of it was, she was a fifth grader, actually outside of Washington, D.C., how did she even hear about the young preservationists? How does she know about the Penn McKee? Somebody had to teach her. And what we are aiming to do with young preservationists, you have to teach the person or persons who can ultimately teach the persons. It has to be an exchange, a constant exchange of information and passion.
Matthew Craig is the executive director of the Young Preservationist Association of Pittsburgh. You can find more information about the group on their Facebook page. I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence.
WYEP celebrates Black History Month with a musical reflection. The Freedom Singers were a musical group that began as an offshoot of the civil rights activist organization, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. The Freedom Singers were established to use the power of music to educate people as well as to raise money for the cause through their performances. The group focused on familiar spiritual and gospel songs, often updated to make them more pointedly about the struggle for civil rights. Bernice Johnson Regan, a member of the group, likened the Freedom Singers to a singing newspaper.
Get on board, children, children, get on board, children, children, let's fight for human rights, get on board.
In the summer of 1963, the Freedom Singers performed at not only the Newport Folk Festival, but at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, the rally at which Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech. After 1963, the lineup of singers fluctuated, and then the group became inactive after 1966. Bernice Johnson Regan later founded the a cappella group Sweet Honey and the Rock. The Freedom Singers have reunited for shows over the years, perhaps most notably at the White House in 2010. For more audio celebrating Black History Month, listen to WYEP throughout February or go to our website at WYEP.org/Black History Month.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. At one time, Pittsburghers knew that if they wanted jazz, they should head to the Hill District, a part of the city that Harlem Renaissance poet Claude McKay called the crossroads of the world because of the vibrant jazz scene. Today, the clubs on the Hill are gone and jazz is spread throughout the region. That sometimes leaves the fans not sure where to go. This inspired the organization Jazz PGH. Members of that organization sat down with 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker to talk about the upcoming Pittsburgh Jazz Days of Winter.
I am joined in the studio by Thomas Wendt, who is a drummer well-known in jazz circles around Pittsburgh. And also, Tom, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And Dr. Harry Clark, who is pretty well known in jazz circles as well, and generations of students who went through Kappa know him as the man who began the Creative and Performing Arts High School in the city of Pittsburgh. Dr. Clark, nice to see you.
Good to be here.
So Pittsburgh Jazz Days of Winter is coming up. Tell me when, and tell me a little bit about what made you decide to do this.
Sure. It's going to run from Saturday, February 16th to Saturday, February 23rd. This is sort of a second go for us. Last August, we presented the Pittsburgh Jazz Days of Summer, which was a week-long celebration of the jazz community here in Pittsburgh, and we're doing it again later this month as the Pittsburgh Jazz Days of Winter.
And you have a lot of events, but it's not actually an atypical stretch of time. There are a lot of events in any given week in Pittsburgh, jazz-wise.
True, yeah.
In fact, you were surprised when Tim Williams from the Carnegie Library sort of on a whim added up all the jazz events in just a random week last year and came up with a surprising number.
As someone who's really involved here in the jazz scene, if somebody were to have asked me, how many jazz events do you think there are in Pittsburgh in an average week? I probably would have said maybe 25 or so. But to learn that there were better than 50 on an average week, we realized that this was something that we need to bring some attention to and give the jazz community a chance to sort of become better known to the greater Pittsburgh area and the Pittsburgh community at large.
And also the people who own the bars and restaurants and night spots where all the music's happening.
We're trying to let them know that here's a way not only to get your name out there, but to be able to support the musicians that are playing there. So okay. If I come into town and I'd like to know what's going on, you know, I can come to your establishment, eat your food, and listen to some good music.
And that's why they're putting a musician up in front of their customers in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah, we've progressed a little from the first week that we did back in August. This time around, we actually now have our own webpage, which is jazzpgh.org. People can go to that website, and from there, they'll be directed to one of two places, either Jazz Central or also the Jazz Near You page here in Pittsburgh. This will allow them to see all the jazz events that are happening.
And that's an important thing because in the past, it has been hard to know, hey, I'd like to catch something. I'd like to see some jazz and hear some jazz.
but where do I go? And you never really had a central place until now.
Absolutely. Right. That's sort of one of the secondary goals of this whole thing, was to give people an easy path to find out what was going on. Because as a musician, like you just mentioned, I constantly have people saying, where can I go to find everything that's happening? Well, this is hopefully going to be the beginning of a permanent solution to that. We should probably mention, too, the Jazz PGH, the group is made up of musicians, this is educators, this is some jazz fans, some venue owners and promoters. It's sort of a real great cross-section of folks from the jazz community that make up the group.
Is there any kind of institutional support for this, any philanthropic organizations helping out?
Well, I guess if we look at some of the organizations like the Kente, African American Jazz Preservation Society of Pittsburgh, Lighthouse Arts Incorporated, and a number of others that are...
Yeah, Manchester Craftsman's Guild, also the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust is involved. The amazing thing about this group is that if you look at our schedule, you'll see basically everyone is involved in this, from people like the Cultural Trust, the August Wilson Center, Kente Arts Alliance, all the way down to, you know, people like, you know, Manny Theiner and myself, who are just, you know, sort of single folks who are, you know, doing what we can do. So that was the goal, is to get as many different people involved as possible.
What is it you would like people to know that are listening to this conversation about jazz in Pittsburgh, about this particular week that you have set aside and labeled Pittsburgh Jazz Days of Winter, and how it all fits into the broader picture of art and culture in Pittsburgh and the social fabric of Pittsburgh?
First of all, it's a very, very rich culture here in Pittsburgh. There are so many fantastic musicians that are playing in this town.
There are so many different kinds of venues. There are so many different kinds of settings that you can hear the music in, and it's just a chance for, through jazzpgh.org, for people to find out about all these events. There is such an amazing variety of artists that are going to be participating this week and every week. For instance, you have, you know, world-renowned people like Renee Marie, Delfeo Marcellus, Gregory Porter will all be performing during that week in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And then there are Pittsburgh veterans who are also known on a larger stage. The great Roger Humphreys will be presenting a concert at the Kelly Strayhorn Theater of all Mary Lou Williams music on the 23rd. Wonderful young drummer George Hyde III hosts a regular Sunday jam session at Wallace's Whiskey Room every Sunday from 7 to 9.
He'll be the Hotel Indigo.
The Hotel Indigo. He'll be participating. Wonderful newer venue here in Pittsburgh, Alphabet City on the north side, City of Asylum. There's going to be three different events, one of which is going to be a two-night celebration of the music of Ornette Coleman on the 19th and 20th. So there's going to be so much different stuff going on, something for everybody. It's also a unique opportunity for, if you're curious about a certain kind of jazz that you've not yet had a chance to experience, I bet you'll be able to do it this week. So it's a great opportunity to maybe check out something new that you are not familiar with.
And a lot of these young musicians are so hungry to get up on stage and present, you know, their craft.
Right.
And it's...
Most of us have you to thank for that, because we came through your school.
Well, and you know what? It is, it's for me, it's so great to sit and look at that and see those students and say to myself, you know what? Now I'm the student.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to thank you guys for taking the time to come in and talk about Pittsburgh Jazz Days of Winter, Jazz PGH, and just... in general, jazz in a city that has been enjoying jazz and creating jazz for pretty much since the very beginning of the art form, for more than a century.
True.
Yes. Thanks so much for having
us. Thanks.
Thomas Wendt, Dr. Harry Clark, good to see you, and I'll see you out somewhere where music's happening.
Thank you, man.
Great.
This is Bob Studebaker for The Confluence.
And for today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, resources abound for opioid users, but there's been less sympathy for those with a meth addiction. How is that lack of resources affecting the LGBTQ community? Is it exacerbating addiction? Plus, we'll look at Stax, giving people access to a catalog of local music from local artists. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.